Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1998. Aesop's Fables and the Rules of Engagement.
Hello. Last week I gave an interview to a news reporter from a television station in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's station WSOC, Channel 9, Michael Eisner's ABC affiliate in Charlotte. The reporter and his cameraman drove up to my broadcast studio in West Virginia. My organization, the National Alliance, has been doing some recruiting in Charlotte, and someone had given a copy of one of our recruiting leaflets to the reporter at a Charlotte gun show. The reporter apparently had checked with his superiors at the television station and been told that the National Alliance is a hate group. So he had come up to check us out and interview me. The reporter was an enthusiastic young man of apparently normal intelligence, although clearly a bit trendy, as nearly all media people are. While we were talking off camera, he told me that he is a recent graduate of Auburn University in Alabama. During the interview, we toured our book department where we stock the books sold by the National Alliance. He noted that we advertise many children's books, and he asked me why. I told him that decent children's books are becoming increasingly difficult for parents to find in bookstores or libraries because the multiculturalists have had a devastating effect on the publishing of children's books, insisting that every illustration in children's literature show a racially mixed group, that homosexuals be portrayed positively, that little girls be shown doing typically boy things, and vice versa. In fact, I said, there has been a real effort afoot to keep traditional children's books away from children. The multiculturalists don't want white children to learn about their own history and traditions. They don't want white children to learn the values and attitudes that are inherent in the sorts of books that white children used to read in America before the Second World War. So the National Alliance searches for good children's books, which the multiculturalists haven't gotten to yet, and makes them available to parents who want their children to learn these traditional values. The reporter asked me for an example. I picked from our shelves a copy of a large, colorfully illustrated edition of Aesop's Fables, which we sell, and handed the book to him. The reporter flipped through the pages and asked me, "What's this all about?" I was surprised by the question, but I answered, "You know, it's the collection of little stories, each with a moral, which have been attributed to the Greek writer Aesop, who lived about 600 B.C., although some of his fables are much older than that." Well, he didn't know. He had never heard of Aesop or his fables, he told me. And I suppose I shouldn't have been surprised. There undoubtedly are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of recent white university graduates in America who have gone through school during the multicultural era and have learned everything they needed to know in order to graduate just by watching MTV regularly. They're trendy parents who also had a multicultural education, saw no need to introduce them to Aesop or to the Brothers Grimm or to any of those other hateful people who wrote children's stories without black or gay heroes and who always portrayed little boys doing boy things and little girls doing girl things. When I was a kid, one of the special charms that Aesop's fables held for me was the knowledge that Alexander the Great, for example, had read exactly these same stories when he was a child more than 2,300 years ago. When I read the fable about the dog in the manger, or the one about the shepherd boy who cried wolf, and thought about the lessons these fables taught, it thrilled me to think that every great man in our history for thousands of years had read these same stories when he was a child and had learned the same lessons. Hey, but no longer. These fables are what the multiculturalists call Eurocentric, not to mention sexist and homophobic. So are the morals the fables teach. And so today they are all no-nos for white children, which is why we have a white population in America which is increasingly ruthless, cosmopolitan, alienated, and atomized. A white population which is unable to defend its heritage or to oppose those whose aim is to destroy that heritage because they have no knowledge of their heritage and who believe that anyone who values that heritage must be a hater, a racist. The professors at Auburn University must be really proud of themselves, and the professors at nearly every other university in America, too. They all are educating citizens for the new world order. Ruthless wonders all. And certainly the last thing that these new world order citizens need to know are the little lessons Aesop was teaching to Greek children 2,600 years ago. Now do you understand why Bill Clinton is the way he is, and why a majority of American voters still think he's an okay guy? Speaking of politicians and voters, I got a big laugh out of what happened to New York's Republican Senator Alphonse D'Amato a few days ago. The poor guy had been counting on holding on to his job as chairman of the Senate Banking Committee by serving as an errand boy for his substantially Jewish constituency. Whatever the Jews wanted, Senator D'Amato fell all over himself in his eagerness to please them. He was the Jews' principal frontman in their huge extortion racket for extracting Second World War reparations from the Swiss people. It was D'Amato, as chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, who twisted the arms of the Swiss and told them that if they didn't cough up all of the money the Jews were demanding, he would introduce legislation cutting off the ability of Swiss banks to do business in the United States. D'Amato would do anything the Jews demanded of him. In order to keep his position in the Senate, he would gladly throw his Italian grandmother to the wolves if it would please the Jews. But in the elections this month, the Jews chose one of their own, Charles Schumer, to take D'Amato's job. So now D'Amato is out of the Senate, out in the cold, without a job. I can imagine him the day after the election going to his biggest Jewish supporters with tears in his eyes and asking, "But why did you desert me? Haven't I always done everything you asked of me, no matter how distasteful or dishonorable it was?" And I can imagine his top Jewish supporter looking coldly down his long nose at D'Amato and answering with a sneer, "Yes, but what have you done for us today?" So, Alphonse D'Amato learned a good lesson about Jewish gratitude. I hope that many others of his type learn similar lessons in the future. I really enjoy seeing the expressions on their faces. You know, I haven't received a letter from Alphonse D'Amato yet, but I have received letters from many other Americans asking me what I have against the Jews. There are many Americans who agree with me on almost every subject except the Jews. They agree with me that the political system which allowed Bill Clinton to be elected is rotten to the core. They agree with me that the quality of the electorate in the United States has declined to the point that democracy has become a threat to our civilization, not to mention a threat to our race. They agree with me on the pernicious influence of the mass media. They agree with me on the disastrous effect multiculturalism has had on our schools and universities. They agree with me that America's present immigration policy, which favors immigrants from the non-white parts of the world, is ruining the country. But when I tell them that the Jews play a key role in each of these problem areas, that the Jews are in large measure responsible for what is wrong with our government, for what is wrong with the mass media, for what is wrong with our schools, for what is wrong with our immigration policy, they run like frightened rabbits. If I corner one of these people who agrees with me on everything except the role of the Jews, I'll hear from him how each of the evils I attribute to the Jews also can be attributed to non-Jews. And I'll also hear from him that there are individual Jews who are opposed to each of these evils. And of course, all of that is true. The Jewish program of extortion against the Swiss and the Germans has depended heavily on corrupt Gentiles like Alphonse D'Amato, for example. And I am sure that one can find individual Jews who believe that this extortion racket is excessively pushy and could backfire on the Jews. But the fact remains that it is a Jewish racket. Despite D'Amato's role as a front man, it is not an Italian racket. It is Jewish. And the same general considerations apply to all of the other problem areas I mentioned. In the mass media, for example, there are bad actors who are not Jews. Rupert Murdoch is the most conspicuous of these. And there are a few Jewish columnists and editors and even publishers who are opposed to most of the destructive policies being promoted by their fellow Jews. Nevertheless, no reasonable person can deny that the influence of the Jews in the media outweighs that of any other ethnic group, and the dissent among media Jews is far outweighed by their agreement on virtually every major issue. Or consider immigration policy. It's not just that the Clinton administration has a Jewish, Doris Meissner, in charge of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which is in line with the extraordinarily high percentage of Jews in other positions in the Clinton administration. The key to our present ruinous immigration policy is that Jews as a whole, not just Doris Meissner as an individual Jew, are in favor of it. There are non-Jews who also favor it, and there are a few Jews who oppose it. But in essence, it is a Jewish policy, and it is the Jewish support for this policy which keeps it in place despite widespread public opposition to it. Or consider the white slave trade, which I have commented on in earlier broadcasts. Corrupt government officials who are not Jews in places like Ukraine make it possible for Jewish slave traders to operate. And in addition to this, there are a few Jews who oppose the white slave trade, not to mention the fact that most Jews are not engaged in the slave trade. But without Jews, there would be no white slave trade. That's the most important point. Not that the Jews have Gentile collaborators, or that most Jews aren't in that particular business, or even that a few Jews oppose the trade, but that it is a Jewish business, and without Jews, we wouldn't have it. And without Jews, we wouldn't have a lot of other problems, too. That doesn't mean that we would have a problem-free society, but at least we would have manageable problems, and we could go to work on them without having to simultaneously fight the media and the government. Above all our other problems today looms the problem of Jewish control of our mass media, with the disastrous influence the media have on all our public institutions, from government to schools, and on private attitudes, opinions, and behavior. To me, that seems self-evident, and I really become impatient with people who refuse to recognize the key role the Jews are playing in the destruction of our civilization, or who pretend to be confused by the fact that not every single Jew is involved, or that non-Jews also are involved. This is a case where too much sophistication simply is not helpful. A case where trying too hard to be reasonable and fair will get us all killed and bring about the end of our civilization. Can you imagine being involved in a war in which the primary rule of engagement was that you are not permitted to shoot at an enemy soldier, regardless of the fact that he was wearing an enemy uniform, until you had personally observed him shooting at you or had personally questioned him and determined his hostile intent? A war in which you were required to assume that a soldier in an enemy uniform really was friendly until you had concrete evidence to the contrary? A war in which your general explained to you that this rule of engagement was justified because most of the enemy soldiers were only support troops, not combat troops, and besides, there were a few soldiers on the other side who weren't really hostile? A war in which you were liable to be court-martialed for anti-Semitism if you actually began shooting enemy soldiers. Can you imagine being in such a war? Clearly, the only way for your side to win would be for you to shoot your subversive general first and then adopt a new rule of engagement under which the simple fact that a soldier was wearing the enemy uniform was sufficient evidence of his hostile intent and sufficient grounds for you to fire on him without further ado. Now, the fact is that we are engaged in just such a war today. It is a war for survival, a war of extinction, of annihilation, a race war to the death. It is a war in which white Americans are being pushed to the wall, are being crowded out of their own land by non-whites of every sort, by blacks, by Hispanics, by Asians, by Middle Easterners, crowded out of their employment, crowded out of their schools, crowded out of their neighborhoods. It is a war in which there can be no truce, no peaceful resolution, only victory or extinction, because the populations of those who covet our living space continue to grow while that space does not. And in this war, our generals, which is to say, our government and our mass media, are telling us that we must not judge our enemies by the uniforms they are wearing, which is to say, by the color of their skin or the tribe to which they belong, but we must ignore their uniforms and judge each of them individually. And we must keep in mind that some of them are pleasant and inoffensive individuals, while there are many very destructive and undesirable individuals among our own people. And especially, we must not judge our generals by the particular Middle Eastern tribe to which so many of them just happen to belong. And, of course, we are losing this war. It is time to shoot some generals and change the rules of engagement. It is time to be a little less confused by sophistries and to call a spade, and to call a Jew a Jew. And it is time to begin considering as traitors those who wring their hands and assert that there's enough space for everyone, and please, can't we all just learn to share and get along with each other? It is time, as is proper during a war, to begin dealing with them as traitors. Before we can do anything else, however, we need first to be able to think clearly about our situation, and then we need to find the courage to deal with it in a reasonable way. Many of our people do understand our situation, many more, I am sorry to say, than have the courage to deal with it properly or even to speak publicly about it. Lack of courage is a bigger problem for us than lack of understanding. The fact is that too many of our people are willing only to take public positions which will not subject them to too much criticism, positions which are not too dangerous and won't get them kicked out of the country club. Of course, What's dangerous depends upon one's station in our society. In many social settings, for example, one can complain about the government's immigration policy if one doesn't become too specific about the racial aspects of that policy. But almost nowhere can one openly talk about the Jewish aspects of immigration policy without risking reprisals. So that leaves on just a few of us now the burden of continuing to speak out, of continuing to explain our situation, of continuing to build understanding in our people. So I'll finish today with a recapitulation. There are many of our people, including educated people, successful people, who, like the television reporter from Charlotte, North Carolina, who interviewed me last week, have never heard of Aesop and who believe that whatever he wrote wasn't really important. They are ignorant and ruthless because they had trendy, airhead parents and went to multiculturalized schools where they were taught by politically correct teachers and professors. And of course, these people will raise their own children in a similar way and send them to schools where they will receive similar educations. So in a sense, it is correct to say that a great many people are responsible for this deplorable situation, for this increasing rootlessness of each succeeding generation of our people. In a sense, the whole society is responsible. There is more to it, however. This rootlessness, whether manifested as ignorance of the oldest traditions of our people or in some other way, is not a natural or accidental development. It has been planned and orchestrated. It is deliberate. The people who planned it, the people who continue to orchestrate it, are Jews. In every society they enter, the Jews immediately begin gnawing on the roots. They understand that only after they have destroyed the people's roots, only after they have made the society rootless and cosmopolitan, will they have free rein and be able to manipulate and exploit the people without resistance. They understand this at an instinctive level. That is why wherever you look, in a society which has been infested by Jews, into whichever festering sore you peer, you will find the Jews at work gnawing on the roots. They have many collaborators among our own people, but the plan to cut our people loose from their roots so we will have no basis for defending our civilization is a Jewish plan, just as the racket to extort billions of dollars from the Swiss and the Germans and other European peoples for wrongs allegedly inflicted during the Second World War is a Jewish racket despite the collaboration of non-Jews such as Alphonse D'Amato. The program to weed all traditional books for white children out of libraries and out of school curricula is a Jewish plan despite the fact that one can find individual Jews who claim to support traditional education and traditional culture. One can find organizations run by Jews which support performances of Shakespeare's plays. One can find Jewish Mozart societies and Jewish Beethoven societies. Perhaps one can even find a Jewish Aesop society if one looks hard enough. But as surely as Aesop is being removed from our culture, so are Shakespeare and Mozart and Beethoven. The Jews appropriate our culture and our traditions before they destroy them. But destruction always is their ultimate aim, and the Jewish mass media are the principal agents of destruction. That is what we must remember. That is why we must change the rules of engagement. Thanks for being with me again today.